Caldwell case, this court has defined that there's no deceitful or dishonest conduct because conspiring to make the government's job harder without more is not a crime in this case. And I submit to the court that all the evidence that was submitted in the district court against the clients lacked a showing of deceitful or dishonest conduct.
What do we do with regard to the timing of the opening of the personal bank account by, I guess it's your client?
It was my client. It was 6 days after.
And then the IRS garnished the corporate business account that she opens.
Because there's nothing illegal, dishonest, or deceitful about it. She had no obligation under the Murphy case to tell the IRS that she was opening up a new account and that she was transferring money into that account. There's nothing illegal about it.
But
there
was single legality comes from the fact that this is circumstantially the jury is permitted to find that as a result of the visit to Kelsey Bill that occurred in 2005, 3 years earlier, that she knew that there were outstanding tax liabilities. The jury could infer that she also knew that the IRS was garnishing the business's accounts in order to satisfy those liabilities. And if you basically aid and abet the hiding of the assets of the taxpayer company to meet those obligations, why? That's not exactly what I would call the innocuous conduct.
But there's nothing deceitful or dishonest about it. She used her name. She used her social security number. She used the address.
But that's somebody gets about to be sued in a civil suit, and they start writing quitclaim deeds and transferring all their assets to the spouse or to their cousin or their brother. I mean, that's still a fraudulent transfer in order to defeat potential creditors, is it not?
It may be in the civil context. It may be in the civil context. Criminal context, you require more than that.
Well, I understand it's a question of the amount of proof, but we're still talking about intent to defraud, or in this case, hiding assets from garnishment by the agency.
Hiding assets alone, without more, without something fraudulent, deceitful, or dishonest, does not under the Caldwell case.
What do we do with the family vacations to Hawaii and buying the Viper? What a Viper is, I think it's a nice place to spot her.
It's a nice place
to spot her. I think it's ironic that they bought a Viper, but that's
The family vacation was in 2005, before the charged conspiracy in this case. And also, the Dodge Viper was not something that
the vacation after the visit by the revenue agents.
But my point is that there has to be some activity in a criminal context that is more than just making the government's job more difficult.
I've been trying to tease this out with you to find out why, given all the circumstantial evidence that was before the jury, that that would not be sufficient as a matter of law for the jury to conclude that she simply lied and deceitful.
Well, because deceitful and deceptive is more than just what is in her mind. The effect of what she did may have had the effect to conceal and hide assets from the IRS.
That's not a client conspiracy, right? Which is classically a conspiracy to obstruct the operations of a federal agency. In this case, obstructing the efforts of the Internal Revenue Service to collect on the tax liability that her husband and their joint family owned the business.
That's correct.
Again, it's a government's theory of liability.
Yes.
That's what the jury convicted her of.
That's what the jury convicted her of. But again, my time is over, but there was nothing deceitful, dishonest about what she did. And that's the decision. I think I'm going to talk to the call about it.
That's not.
That's not.
Okay. Next time. Sure.
Good morning, Your Honors. George Harris on behalf of Defendant Appellant Jason Orlandi. And I'd like to address first the statute of limitations issues, and in particular the ineffective assistance of counsel issue. It's uncontested here that if the request had been made for statute of limitations, the instructions had been properly raised, that the defendants were entitled to instructions that the jury must find, you know, specified affirmative acts within the statute of limitations for the tax evasion count, and must find an overt act within the statute of limitations for the conspiracy count. So, instead, the jury was allowed to convict based on acts outside of those periods. The contested issues, the only contested issues, were first, was this the result of ineffective assistance, and two, was it prejudicial? So, first of all, on the ineffective assistance, I think here we can address it on appeal. It's plain on the face of the record what counsel's reasons were. They were addressed in two supplemental filings as requested by the district court after counsel had attempted to raise statute of limitations issues in a post-trial motion. And counsel made it clear that he erroneously believed that it could be raised as a basis for acquittal, having not made the request for a jury instruction. That was simply wrong.
He didn't make a Rule 29 motion either, did he? On that ground, specifically?
He did raise that ground in his Rule 29 motion for acquittal. Yes. But that was the first time he had raised it without raising it.
Well, I thought the first three chapters of locations came in the bill of particulars.
Yes. I mean, counsel mentioned in the bill of particulars, he actually mentioned it during the conference on the jury instructions, but what he didn't do was actually request an instruction. So the court said, you're too late, you know, you're out of luck.
This is what we do with the fact that this really goes to the prejudice problem, I think, rather than the first problem.
Right.
There's strictly, I mean, the fact that the indictment lists literally hundreds of overt acts from the deposits and writing of checks and so on, in furtherance of the crime conspiracy that occurred well within the statute of limitations. Even though the opening of the bank account, I think, and maybe three or four of the first transactions arguably were barred by the statute of limitations.
Right. So I think we need to address the prejudice issue in two parts for the two counts. If I may, I'd address the tax evasion count first.
Count your claim was convicted on, but the wife was not.
Yes, correct. And that's earlier in time, though it's count two in the indictment. And here, the jury was presented with four affirmative acts in two very distinct sets. The evidence was very distinct. The first set had to do with false statements to the IRS, allegedly made in April of 2005, outside of the limitations period. The second set had to do with actions later in the year, August to December of 2005. And this was, you know, the purchase of automobiles with corporate accounts, the vacation trip, the sort of commingling of corporate and personal. But it was a totally separate set of events. So the jury was allowed to convict. We don't know, you know, what they found. We don't know if they relied on the false statements to the IRS, which were frankly the most direct evidence of.
But let's assume that in light of my discussions with your co-counsel there, that the jury was focused on the actions of one husband and wife after the guardianship proceedings were initiated in August of 2008. Wouldn't you agree that there literally are hundreds of overt acts that are within the statute that occurred?
Well, I think that's a separate issue with regard to conspiracy.
So I'm looking at prejudice here, and I'm still having a hard time. I understand what you're trying to do in terms, and it's a perfectly appropriate argument, in terms of segregating the different components of obstructive behavior. But in light of the substantial amount of banking activities that occurred, if the jury concluded that those activities
It's not relevant to the tax evasion claim, but on the conspiracy claim, yes. I mean, the question is, can they find an overt act within the period?
They only need to find one.
They only need to find one, but
they can consider all this other conduct under principles of liability.
Yeah. That's true, Your Honor, but the cases, the controlling precedent here, and this is the Yates case and the Fuchs case, which follows it, says that, you know, if the jury could find, based on acts that were inside or outside, and we don't know which, that, you know, we need to reverse. We need to go back.
Well,
and that is the circumstance.
If we find prejudice, I mean, the problem we have here is a plain error issue, right, on the failure to request the instruction.
Well, here's a reasonable probability error. It's also a harmless error because it's really a Chapman standard, because under the Hedgepeth case, even under Yates, we have to find that beyond a reasonable doubt that it, you know, could not have affected it. I think here, in Fuchs, the court said, well, the evidence was not overwhelming, so the question is, was it overwhelming here? I think this really, that's my colleague's argument in part, which I'd like to add to, because the evidence was not overwhelming with regard to conspiracy. And what was really missing here was evidence that Justice Sartorling, that Ms. Sartorling knew about the tax liability that was an issue here for the conspiracy.
It's not a bit of a weird argument to make, given the length of time that transpired. She was running, she incorporated the business originally.
She
went back in 2000.
Yes, she was not incorporated in the business, but the taxes that are issued, the tax that were owed, the $83,000 that was owed here, most of it, you know, goes back to personal income taxes. Mr. Sartorling never filed his own leave before they were married. And it has to do, you know, with payments while the business was still an individual proprietorship. The taxes were paid by the corporation. Those were not an issue. Those were not owned. And to go back to the what the government relies on is one meeting, one time that the IRS actually had contact with Ms. Sartorling. That was, by the way, was February of 2006, not well, February of 2005. And here's the entire testimony of what happened at that meeting.
I read it.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, this is Excerpt of Record 156.
We basically immediately handed the phone to the agents and talked to my husband. He doesn't want me talking to him.
Yes, so there's no evidence.
But, I mean, given what she then did later, why can't the jury conclude that she knew as early as February 2006 that he owed the IRS for unpaid taxes, and then he did all these things that happened, the Viper,
well, the garbage of those are 2005 and they're before that. And what the government really has to show here is that she knew about the taxes that they were trying to collect and that they were trying to collect them.
Well, the IRS wrote an agent's knock on your door. It's not a good day.
Well, this is 2 years before the alleged beginning of the conspiracy.
Right. And she finds out in August of 2008 that they're actually garnishing the bank account.
Well, then
she opens her personal corporate account.
Yeah. Actually, there's no evidence that she knew about the levy.
Then why is she having all of the corporate expenses in her personal account if she didn't know?
This is 2008.
Yeah.
This is when the real estate business fell apart. This is when all of the,
and that's your explanation for why she said she started paying corporate expenses in her personal account.
Well, yes. And, you know, the object can be avoiding other creditors, and the object can even be illegal as long as it's not the object of tax evasion that's alleged. And here, the evidence showed
the deficiency notice was issued on, what was the date, August 11th, 2008, and the bank account was open, like, within 2 weeks.
It was a levy on the personal account,
right, on the corporate account, where they dropped $4,600 or something.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the amounts, but what we don't have is evidence that she knew about that levy. In fact, the government relies on the accountant says she was there.
And again, is that what the real estate market is like? It was okay for her to run corporate expenses on personal account.
Yeah.
That's been a real problem, as you can tell.
Oh,
yes. The use of the personal account, that's what I think is, it's a really inconvenient fact for the defense.
Well, the evidence also shows that the person, that the corporate account in the for personal, but they've gone back and forth for many years. That was kind of a practice. The accounts that you go through
actually depositing revenue to the business and running its other account and then writing checks to pay
was not a conspiracy for a tax evasion, and there was food evidence.
No idea that the IRS had trapped $4,600 in a corporate account 2 weeks earlier, and completely forgotten that the revenue agents had been knocking on her door in 2007.
Well, I mean, that's 2 years before the alleged conspiracy. She has no specifically. Ingram says he must be evidence of knowledge, not to be clear, not equivocal. So I think the IRS might be held by evidence. I seem like
your claims are clear, and I didn't want to give the government a chance.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the Court, Kirsten Hall of the United States. The jury's verdict in this case should not be overturned because the district court did not commit any error, let alone plain error. Let me address the statute of limitations issue first. That issue is controlled by the Supreme Court's decision in Musacchio. The defendants did not raise the statute of limitations as an issue before or at trial. Under the Supreme Court's Musacchio decision, that means they are barred from raising it on appeal. It is not, according to the Supreme Court, error at all, let alone plain error. Period. The court ordinarily does not consider ineffective assistance of counsel claims on appeal, but if this court were to consider it, this is not a case to reverse, or in fact, the government wins on this issue because, as Judge Tolman pointed out, there is simply no prejudice in this case. The counsel, either count was barred by the statute of limitations, so that even if the defendants had gotten the instruction they now claim they want, they still would have been convicted anyway.
So what was beyond the statute of limitations here?
So the statute of limitations for count one. The statute of limitations for count one. The conspiracy was charged from August 11, 2008 to August 11, 2009. The statute of limitations began to run on September 8, 2008, so there were 29 days outside of the statute of limitations. The only acts that occurred outside of the statute of limitations were the opening of the account, Mr. Soderling's statement that the reason why she opened the account was to avoid the tax levy imposed by the IRS, which is also evidence that the jury had before them, as he explicitly stated that's why he was going to ask her to open the account. And then four direct deposits of less than $10,000 that were made into that account. The rest of the $150,000 of deposits and withdrawals that were made to and from that account all occurred within the limitations period. There were over 70 transactions. In addition, all of the instances in which Mrs. Soderling held herself out as the owner of the corporation's assets so that she could auction them off and then take those proceeds and deposit them into her account, all of those auctionings occurred within the limitations period. For count two was charged as a tax evasion from September 16th, 2004 through August 25th of 2005. There was a 6-year statute of limitations that began to run on September 8th, 2005, so approximately 1 year was outside of the statute of limitations. However, the affirmative acts that were alleged in the indictment began on April 12th, 2005. There were four affirmative acts that were alleged in the indictment, and the jury was instructed on them. Two of them occurred on April 12th, 2005. The remainder of them, the purchase of the Dodge Viper, the vacation, the property sales, all occurred, for the most part, within the limitations period. Sometimes payments would be made outside the limitations period, but the majority of the payments occurred within the limitations period. And as we pointed out in our brief, there's no way that the jury could have found that those payments that occurred within the limitations period were evidence of the tax fraud without also finding that Mr. Soderling made the misstatements in April 12th of 2005. They were linked together because the reason why the statements were false was because he told the IRS, I don't have any money, when in fact he was using the corporate money as his own personal bank account. So the supposition that the defense makes that they could have found outside the limitations period acts and not within the limitations period act is simply not factually possible. Moreover, because of Musacchio, it doesn't matter because they didn't raise it. With regard to the sufficiency of the evidence, there was ample evidence from which the jury could conclude that Mrs. Soderling and Mr. Soderling agreed to defraud the IRS by hiding Mr. Soderling's assets from the IRS so they could not collect them. For First, Mrs. Soderling was an active participant in the conspiracy. This is not a case where Mr. Soderling opened an account in her name, and then she didn't know anything about it. She proceeded to write corporate checks as if in her name, as if she was the owner of the corporation, which she knew she was not. She held out corporate assets. She held herself out as the owner of corporate assets, which she knew she did not own. Mr. Soderling told his accountant, Mr. Bauer, that the purpose of these actions was to avoid any further garnishment of his money by the IRS. That is direct evidence of the reason for the conspiracy. Mr. Soderling never told Mr. Bauer to hide what they were doing from Mrs. Soderling, even though she was in the office on a regular basis, signing these checks on a regular basis. If he was trying to hide the actions from Mrs. Soderling, he probably would have told Mr. Bauer not to tell him anything about it, and he didn't. And the service of the IRS levy represented a sea change in how the company did business. Before that, Mr. Soderling signed all the checks. Mr. Soderling was the owner of everything. After that, this is and these actions were not taken in isolation, but after the Soderlings had been shielding Mr. Soderling's assets from the IRS since 2002, when Mrs. Soderling's name was put on the incorporation documents, not Mr. Soderling's name. And as the court has noted, during those collection efforts, two revenue agents visited Mrs. Soderling at her home in 2006. She didn't ask them what they were doing there. She didn't say, why are you here? The jury could infer from that that she already knew why they were there. And when she picked up the phone and called her husband, she didn't ask him what was going on either. And the jury could infer from that that they had already discussed this issue. And this explanation that the defense has now come up with, that she opened these accounts to avoid corporate creditors, that is something that they have brought up for the first time on appeal. There is simply no evidence that was presented to that to the jury. There was no argument made to the jury that that was why they did it. Their argument,
I take it, they
did
have an opportunity to argue to the jury that the government had proven that they did.
Yes, Your Honor. And below, their argument was that they simply didn't conceal anything. Their argument was not, yes, we concealed it, but we did it for a different purpose. And so for the jury to conclude that, the jury would have had to come up with that up. Any further questions from the court? Thank you.
Just a couple of points very quickly. And the first has to do with the tax evasion count two. So each offense are linked together. You can find one or find the other. They're totally separate. The evidence referred to those outside of the period has to do with statements on April 12, 2005. Formed into the agent, and they had to do with what the assets were and whether certain property sales were disclosed. The later evidence about whether there were corporate accounts used for other purposes, I think, is totally simple. So here we're clearly, I think, within the Yates kind of through situation where we don't know which is the jury.
I
don't
know where you think all of them were.
Thank you. And secondly, the government relies, when we get to the conspiracy count, the issue, again, is whether Ms. Soderling knew. There's only two members of this conspiracy. If she doesn't know, under Ingram, there's not a conspiracy. And they rely on that the accountant says, well, I wasn't told not to tell her about the letter. But he also, never testified that he did tell her or that anyone told her. And there's no evidence that they did. And again, it's not the clear, not equivocal evidence that Ingram requires. And then as to whether there's any evidence of another possible motive here, and the fact that there were other creditors out there, and you didn't have to be a tax levy in order to perhaps be doing this.
You made to the jury, or is this a new argument?
Yes, and that's what I want to refer you to, Your Honor. What was the evidence, and this is Excerpt of Record 92-101, is that Mr. Bauer, the accountant, testified that at that point there was no money to pay the bills, they had to let the employees go, vehicles that he had repossessed. So there was evidence in the record that there was also other pressure on these individuals and on this business other than the IRS. So, again, what the government had to prove and did not was that she knew that the purpose was to evade these particular taxes.
argument submitted. We'll do a decision as soon as we can, and we are adjourned.